B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host.
Hey, you keep it down?
Please, the Masters.
Oh, right.
And now, here's your host, a man whose high school nickname was Azalea. True story, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. I hope this podcast finds you all safe, healthy, and missing golf more than ever. I say that because to me, this week is high holy days. I spent 5.5 years living and working in Augusta, Georgia. I fell in love with all things Augusta National Golf Club and the Masters. I've been fortunate enough to attend the tournament several times in recent years with my son, and I've actually played the course on many occasions as well. I'm going to be honest, there's a huge hole in my heart and life this week without the greatest golf tournament in the world. And if you feel even remotely the same, I hope this helps. Mark Cannizzaro is a sports writer with the New York Post and has covered the Masters for more than a quarter century. He's just come out with a new book called 7 Days in Augusta that is special in that throughout, it provides a point of view as if you've never been to the tournament. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Mark, before we get into your book, I would be remiss if we didn't take a few minutes just to talk about some of the news. We've had weeks without really any significant golf news, and then all of a sudden we got a ton this week as we have one major bowing out, three that have rescheduled, and the PGA Tour sort of hinting as to when they might resume operations. What was your reaction to, first off, the Masters in November?
Well, that was rumored for a while. As soon as the Masters announced it was postponed. What happened here, Charlie, is Augusta National closes down at the end of May every year and doesn't reopen until
mid-October, yeah.
Yeah, mid-October. So the speculation immediately ran to, you know, sometime in mid to late October or maybe even November. So that position didn't surprise me that much. What surprised me the most, to be honest with you, was the British Open canceling completely.
I heard something about an insurance policy weighing heavy in that decision. It almost sounded like an Anthony Kim Lloyds of London deal. Can you sort of explain what that was?
Golf Digest reported that, and I have every reason to believe it because I believe Wimbledon had a similar thing where they have an insurance policy against some sort of catastrophic event like this pandemic. Canceling the event or having to move the event.
Right.
So I did I believe that is the case. I guess maybe kind of cutting the losses, so to speak, if you will. I look at all of these other reschedulings here. I think every one of the golf's governing bodies kind of they all got together, and obviously Monday was a flurry of announcements. Everybody just has their fingers crossed that these will actually go off as rescheduled. We have no idea.
Right.
Where this is going. I don't know what it's like down in Charlotte, but obviously, here in New York, and New Jersey, where I am right now, we're in the epicenter of it here, it seems. So, I would think, the PGA Tour is talking about, restarting in June. I mean, that's just 2 months off now. So I cannot imagine that there are going to be fans and spectators at the golf at the tournaments. When they get started.
No. I'm right there with you. I always thought that golf might be the first sport back because by nature of the game, it doesn't require fans. It doesn't require you having contact with your opponent or your opponent's equipment. So I always knew that if a sport was going to come back first, it was going to be golf. And I was telling someone a few years ago when the PGA was here in Charlotte. We had a bad thunderstorm come up on a Friday afternoon during the second round, and all of the spectators were kicked off the course, and when play resumed, it was just the media and the players. And I remember walking around going, this has to be surreal to these guys. They're playing a major championship, and it looks like they're playing just a round with their buddies on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it is surreal, and it's funny. Andy North, interesting. He was a dear friend of mine from ESPN. I saw him on the air a couple of nights ago, saying that he felt like if no fans were going to be allowed at the tournaments, he didn't think the tournament should take place at all. And I disagree vehemently with that because I think we're all so starved for sports right now, you know. I mean, Charlie, at this point, we're anticipating the NFL draft like it's, you know, like it's the Super Bowl coming up in 2 weeks, you know. I mean, just because it's some semblance of consequential sporting event, you know.
And this is selfish because we love the game of golf. I think this could be really, really great for the game of golf because of what you just said. Everyone is so starved. I think if it was a ping pong tournament, millions of people would tune in just to see a live event. But I think, you know, people are going to tune in to the first sport back, whatever it is. And if it's golf, you know, who knows what good might come from, you know, millions of eyes that normally wouldn't have tuned into a golf tournament actually tuning in and going, hey, you know, maybe I can play this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think the spot where I think it'll be most weird, If this just, you know, hypothetically, if the no spectator thing took place, like say for the balance of the rest of this year, and we go into the Masters and there's no fans there, you know, the Masters. Have you guys attended?
I lived and worked in Augusta for 5.5 years. So yeah.
So you know that the part of the lore of the Masters are those roars you hear around the grounds. You know, and now I don't know if that comes off on television as much, but if you're there, it's something to behold, really.
Well, and each roar is unique. There was a
each
Nicholas.
Unique. You know if it's an eagle roar or a birdie roar, or maybe you could even decipher like a par save roar, you know.
Well, and you knew the player. You knew a Nicholas roar.
Yeah,
you knew a Tiger roar. They were unique.
No question about it. So I think that, you know, it's weird because I think that the Masters could probably go off with no fans as a television event better than anywhere else because people are just, I mean, we're all just fascinated to see what Augusta National looks like. And certainly we're going to be fascinated to see what it looks like in November. But, you know, I think it would really be, it would hurt the atmosphere if you happen to be somebody that goes there. But I think for television, I don't think it would make that much of a difference for TV because, you know, I just, you know, the fans, it's you know, you don't, it's not like watching an NFL game or a big college football game or another sport where you can kind of feel the fan vibe through the television screen, so to speak. I think golf is much more of a quieter, you know, vibe than that when you're watching television in terms of, you know, even the fans. So, but, you know, it would be a shame, but listen, particularly for the people because, you know, that's the hardest ticket in sports, you know, the Masters, as you know. And for those people that have tickets and, you know, can't go, if that's the case, that'll be terrible. But I think it would come off just as beautifully without fans, the Masters, in my opinion, as it would with fans.
Yeah, the only thing that concerns me, there's so many moving parts, and you know this having written your book. By the way, we're talking with Mark Cannizzaro, New York Post, written a book called 7 Days in Augusta. I promise we'll get to his book here momentarily. But you know, having been down there, that so much of the Masters is about the volunteers, and people don't realize that in about a 70-mile radius around the city of Augusta, every school district takes the same spring break every year. It's Masters Week because everyone is sort of associated in some form or fashion with the tournament, and for them to pull off the volunteerism in November is going to be interesting, especially with the economic climate the way it is right now. Will people be able to get off work? Also, having lived there, it gets dark early. I mean, dark at 5:30 in November, and you could be dealing with frost delays. There's all sorts of moving parts and things that are going to go down if this does happen that are going to make it really interesting for them to pull off.
Yeah, there are. One thing, Charlie, that, you know, as you know, it's a smaller field for the Masters, so, you know, it's not as challenging in terms of, you know, the darkness setting in and all that kind of stuff. Now, certainly if you get into some frost delays, it complicates things, but they can have earlier tee times than they normally would, and, you know, and if they have to go off two tees, they could do that. You know, whatever you have to do, you know, to make it work, you know, I think Augusta will be able to do that. The volunteer thing is interesting because I'm almost wondering, you know, do they shift things and have a school vacation that week if fans are going to be allowed? Now, the volunteer thing, if there's going to be no spectators, there's going to be a lot less volunteers that are needed, obviously. You don't need people at the food stands and all that kind of thing. So, you know, the merchandise facilities and all those things. So, that's a big moving part, too. Will there be spectators? But if there are spectators and you need all those volunteers, you know, I would not be surprised if they altered the school year and try to make it so that, you know, schools were off during that stretch, so they could, you know, they could use a lot of these kids.
Again, Mark Canizero is the author of 7 Days in Augusta, our guest taking Dead Aim. I love that various portions throughout your book are written from the point of view of what a person would experience at Augusta National. So many books are written as historical documents about the club, and I love them too. But, you know, like you said, it's a hard ticket to get, and so many people don't have that experience. My first Masters was 97. Because of Tiger and its historical... Oh, yeah, I know. Because of Tiger and its historical significance, it's memorable, of course. But to me, the image I'll never forget is the first time I laid eyes on the course, and I've described it as the moment in The Wizard of Oz where we go from Kansas sepia to Oz Technicolor. How do you describe that first moment? I know your first one was 94. How do you describe that first moment to someone who's never seen it before?
Well, I refer back to it as I remember the first time my dad brought me to a baseball game here in New York. I'm actually a Yankee fan, but it was a Met game. It was a Mets-Phillies doubleheader at Shea Stadium in 1973, 74. Willie Mays was playing for the Mets at the time, and it was a twilight doubleheader, and I'll never forget that moment when we walked through the portal, you know, for when you're kind of where the concession stands are, and you're walking through the portal to get out to where the seats are, the lights beaming on the green outfield grass. I don't know what it is about it. It's seared in my memory for life. And you know, I'm 58 years old, and that was you know, I was probably 11 at that time or whatever I was, and that to me is what walking into Augusta National for the first time was like. The first time I remember walking through the gates. Now, first of all, as you know from living down there, Washington Road is that four-lane honky-tonk road with, you know, strip malls and every single chain restaurant there is on the planet has an outlet there. Grocery stores, strip joints, you name it, you know. And then you have this little teeny Magnolia Lane with a sign that says Augusta National Golf Club on it that's about as large as a bar napkin, basically, right?
If it's not Masters Week and you're driving down Washington Road, you will speed right by it and go, oh, wait, that was it? Because...
Oh, yeah, absolutely, no question. But I'll never forget going through with my media badge and kind of walking, before they've done all the new construction there,
right,
walking through that little villagey area there where they got the merchandise area, which is to the right, and just getting out and just seeing the green grass, the perfectly manicured green grass, not a weed out there, not a pine needle out of place. That to me was like that first time that I walked out and saw baseball, Major League Baseball field for the first time. So that's the way I remember it. I oddly ask, because one of my early chapters of the book is I talked to a lot of the players that I've come across, interviewed a lot of the players about what their first impressions were of the, you know, of Augusta National. So, and you got a lot of kind of varying, you know, impressions about, you know, of that.
You know, in my mind's eye, watching the tournament all those years, I just had this image in my head, this idyllic image of Augusta National being this nook tucked away in a forest somewhere on the outskirts of town.
Exactly.
And I'll never forget driving by and going, hell, there's a Food Lion right across the street from Augusta National. It was kind of a letdown. Did you feel the same?
I did. And you know what? When I first started going there, the media parking lot was that big gravel lot.
Yes.
I remember right out in front.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and it was just like you drove into this gravelly lot like you were going to some, you know, like a horse show or something like that. You know. And you just walk through the gates, and it was. But yeah, it was. You know, I'm the same way. You know, I got off I-20, you know, the interstate there, and got on Washington Road off the exit. And I'm driving. I'm looking at all these, you know, crappy places up in the north end, you know, up and down the streets. And I'm like, where is this place? I'm looking at my GPS. I'm like, it's on this road, really? You know. And there it is, you know, it's, you know, and you wouldn't know it was there. Of course, now you know it was there because now they've blown out all those neighborhoods out there. They bought out all those homes and made it into 300 acres of parking, basically, for that one week a year. But, yeah, it is just, it's the most unique, I would say, place. I would just say sporting venue, but it's just one of the most unique places, really, anywhere. You know, and that tournament, as you know from being down there, you know, my colleague John Boyette, who you've probably come across, who used to be the sports editor of the Augusta Chronicle, which is the Masters Bible, and I did a chapter on the Augusta Chronicle and what they do. Boyette used to always call it the second Christmas in Augusta every year, you know?
That's Mark Cannizzaro, author of 7 Days in Augusta. And when we return, he takes dead aim at the magic of the Masters. A couple of the tournament's special traditions and more, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors, and we continue now with Mark Cannizzaro, author of 7 Days in Augusta. Your first four Masters that you covered were Olathabal winning after getting a note from Seve, Crenshaw winning after the death of Harvey Penick, Norman's collapse in 96, and then Tiger is 97. As a writer, we don't root for winners or losers, we root for the story, and your first 4 years, you didn't have to look very far.
I didn't have to look very far, and I will tell you this, too, Charlie. After the Tiger thing, which was my fourth in a row, because, you know, I literally walked out. I'm not like an overly religious person. I'm a believer, but I'm not an uber religious person. But I walked out of there thinking to myself, there is literally something mystical going on and magical that takes place at this place, because the most amazing story rises to the surface every year. Now, we've had a couple of duds, but, you know, over the years in my 25 that I've covered, no offense to the guys that won them, but you know, that said, how many duds really have there been? I mean, almost every year, it's an incredible story, you know?
I've always marveled that the men of the Masters understand so acutely and adroitly that it is entertainment. It's a television show. And their goal on the weekend is not to punish these guys, but to set these guys up to be great and to show how great they are. They're the only major championship that really gets this concept. And so consequently, when you set these guys up for greatness, greatness happens more times than not.
Yes, and when you're setting that up, you know, when you're talking about that setup, you know, for our listeners that might not understand, there's a certain way that you can set the golf course up, you know, where you put the pins on the greens, you know, whether some of the tees are up or back or whatnot. And absolutely, you know, on Saturday particularly, I mean, is in a notorious, you know, obviously people know it as quote-unquote moving day at golf tournaments where guys make their big moves. And they set Saturday up every year for it to be moving day. I mean, there are birdies and eagles all over the place, and they've got the pins and bowls in some places. And you're right. And you know, there's been a few times, Charlie, over the last few years as everybody's tried to make these courses harder, where I think the chairman have lost their way a little bit, and they made it a little bit too difficult, and some of the pins were on edges where they probably shouldn't have been. And you know what? They realized we have no roars. There's no roars. People aren't roaring for somebody grinding for par like they do at U.S. Opens. So, you know, they smartened up and they went back to it, you know, but they did lose their way a little bit for a stretch there.
Mark Cannizzaro is author of 7 Days in Augusta, our guest Taking Dead Aim. You mentioned you've talked to a lot of golfers in your book, and there's a lot of people who have an almost or I should have won story at Augusta.
Yeah.
Do you find that more than any other major, this is the one that got away that's regretted most? I don't hear golfers talk about, oh, well, I had a chance to win the U.S. Open or this, but you hear them all talk about, I was there on Sunday at Augusta, and I couldn't make a damn putt. It just slipped through my fingers.
There's no question about it, and you know, part of that reason is because the Masters is the Masters. It's maybe the most coveted major, the most anticipated major of all four of them. The other side is it's the hardest one to get into. You know, it's a smaller field. You know, they have a lot of invites for a lot of the international players and whatnot, and the amateurs and stuff. So the pool for pros to get in there is not that large. So, you know, the guys that I think of most, obviously the top of the list is Norman, you know, who threw away 96 famously. But, you know, Norman also had a couple stolen from him. You know, I mean, Olathabal's second victory, I want to say 99, you know, absolutely, you know, crushed Norman's will, and Norman didn't throw that one away.
No.
You know, obviously one of the most famous ones was Larry Mize. Yeah. Larry Mize chipping in on Norman in a playoff in 1987. you know, which I did not cover, but, you know, I mean...
Well, and that was from a point on 11 where Mize was dead. I mean, that ball, he was dead. There's no way he gets that within 12 feet of the hole without putting it in Ray's Creek on the other side. I mean, no way.
No question. And you know, and another guy on that list is, and who I feel terrible for, is Ernie Els. And he's prominently displayed in one of my chapters about the guys that have kept... You know, I talked to Ernie last year. I interviewed him for the book last year at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, and it was one of the most stunning interviews for the book that I did of any of them. Because even the guys that have had bad goes at Augusta National, they still have a romantic view of the Masters, right? And you know, I can't use the words that Ernie used, but you know, he said it was a blanking nightmare for him, Augusta. And wow. You know, Ernie's past the point now where he's ever going to play again. You know, he's never going to play again. And I said, so you don't have a romantic view of Augusta? He said, no, it was an effing nightmare. And he said that golf course treats some golfers like Phil, Tiger, Fred Couples, go on down the line. You know, Freddie Couples with the ball hanging on the bank in 92, not going to Ray's Creek. Certain guys have gotten the breaks there, right? Yeah. And then he said there's guys like me and Weisskopf, who has, famously never won it, and certain guys like that, There's been a lot of near misses there. I mean, Phil Mickelson ripped the heart out of Ernie in 2004, if you remember. I mean, Mickelson won his first major and his first Masters in 2004. And Ernie Els had one of the most extraordinary back nines you'll ever see. And he didn't win the golf tournament because Phil was a tick better. I mean, so those kind of things are so much a part of the Masters lure. You know, if I could just do a quick aside, which you mentioned, I mentioned Mize. Larry Mize grew up, obviously, in Augusta, which is one of the most amazing stories there in Masters history, right?
Right.
And he grew up with the guy that owns T-Bones, the steakhouse that I do, the local steakhouse there that I did a chapter on. And Mark, who's the owner of T-Bones, told me this great story. He went to high school with Mize, and he's like, all of us were out chasing girls and drinking beer, stealing our dad's beer, and Larry Mize was out there banging balls at the range all day long. And Mark told me, they used to joke to Mize, what are you out in the golf course all day for? What do you think you're going to do, win the Masters one day? And he did, So I love that
Absolutely.
Kind of just little anecdotal thing was just kind of cool,
Mark Cannizzaro is the author of 7 Days in Augusta, our guest taking Dead Aim. I believe, and this word is thrown around a lot for various reasons, and the word's tradition, but I think the greatest tradition in all of sports is the reason why everybody wants to win the Masters. And that's the champions dinner on Tuesday night. It's the most exclusive. It's the coolest frat dinner in the world. I'd give my right arm to be a fly on the wall just once. And I love in your book how forthcoming and candid Phil was with stories about that championship dinner. And I get the feeling reading your book that even a Hall of Famer like Phil, that he sits around in that room on that Tuesday night and pinches himself every now and again to be with that company of guys.
There's no question. And Phil, actually wrote the foreword for me in the book, which was really, incredible of him to do and a real cool read. Phil is a guy who, likes to think he knows a lot about everything. He's a big BSer, and he loves to talk, and he loves to tell stories, and he loves the attention. And he told me that is the one night he doesn't want to tell any stories. He just wants to sit back and listen to the stories of the old timers and the old greats, that have won the green jackets. And, that's pretty powerful when you hear that. And, that tradition to me, and I think the honorary starters, who would be, as we speak right now, would be Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus tomorrow morning at about 7:45 at the first tee, kicking off the official start of the tournament. I think that, to me, when I first started covering the tournament, and it would have been around one time when you were there, it was Byron Nelson, Sam Snead, and
Squire,
and Saracen. I mean, I'm 58 years old. I wasn't anywhere near alive when those guys were winning those tournaments and becoming legends. And to see those guys out there was something. And a few years ago, with the first of those when Arnie was not alive, was maybe the most powerful moment I can remember in the history of my 25 Masters. you know, when Gary and Jack were out there, and Billy Payne was a chairman at the time, and he had a chair out there with Arnold's green jacket draped over the back of it. And my God, that was emotional. Wow, that morning, I've got goosebumps talking about it.
Well, I'll tell you what was equally as emotional was the year before. My son and I were there when they wheeled Arnold out in the golf cart. And having been around Arnold many times over the years, there was always, and you know this because you covered him and you met him and you talked to him. There are certain people in this world who have a sparkle in their eyes.
No question.
And Arnold Palmer had a perma sparkle in his eyes. And when we were standing there, when Arnold drove by, and the eyes were lifeless. And I just, my heart sank. And I, you know, he was unable to, they got him out to the first tee. He was unable to stand, really. He was unable, of course, to take a swing. And he died several months later. And I will always say that I believe that was a contributing factor to Arnold's death. I think his heart broke that day that he was unable to perform for the people, to be Arnold Palmer at Augusta. To me, it was one of the sadder moments I've ever witnessed in sports.
Well, Charlie, I tell you, it's interesting you say that because, and that observation about the look in his eyes, you know, at when the U.S. Open was at Oakmont, I went over to La Trobe, to Country Club, and saw Arnold there. I'd never been to La Trobe before, and I wanted to see it. And he was sitting in his usual spot in the grill room, with his back to the wall at an 8-top table with Doc Giffen, his right hand man, and a number of other friends with him. And we went over and said hello to him, and he said, "Hey, sit down, join us for lunch." It was one of the most amazing afternoons I've ever had in my life. And we sat there. The U.S. Open, the early part of the U.S. Open was on television, and we were watching on TV with Arnie, and he had a vacant look in his eye that you just described that I'll never forget. It just was different, you know, and Arnold Palmer invented the it factor, in my opinion.
Yes.
We always talk about athletes and stars having an it factor. Arnie invented the it factor in my generation anyway. And I'm not saying the it factor was gone because he was only Arnold Palmer, but that look in his eye, you're absolutely right. There was a vacant look in his eye that day at lunch, and it was sad. It was eye-opening, no pun intended.
They will have to drag Gary's dead carcass off of the first tee. I can see a moment where Jack goes, "Hey, you know, I'm tired of doing this," and he doesn't do the honorary thing anymore. Who's next on deck? Is it Crenshaw, Watson, Couples, combination thereof?
Charlie, can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
I before I answer that second part of the question, I did an interview with Jack and Gary the last couple of days, actually. We were emailing each other, actually, and for a column I'm writing for tomorrow's New York Post, actually, about kind of what they miss about not being there this week and kind of the juxtaposition of that, the fact that they should be there tomorrow morning hitting that first tee shot. And Jack had this great line. He was talking about how, you know, because I asked him a question about the first tee shot, and you know what it means to him and whatnot with Gary and all that. And he said, you know, Gary's out driving me now because he plays more golf than I do. And he said the last couple of years have been out driving me. And as you and I know, Jack has 6 green jackets and Gary has 3. Jack said he feels like the last couple of years when Gary's been out driving him, Gary's acquired a 4th green jacket and a 5th green jacket just for out driving Jack. Okay. And the other anecdote to that was yesterday I was on a conference call for the President's Cup, and Trevor Immelman, a former Masters winner and a South African who's extremely influenced by Gary Player, I asked him about the, you know, the first tee thing, and he gave me this great anecdote about a couple of years back when he had an early tee time that was, you know, not too far along after the ceremony for his tee shots, and he was out on the range getting ready for his tee time. So he got out there. He said Gary was already out on the range working through his bag like he was about to play the final round of the Masters, right? Or maybe even 36 holes. He said he's hitting drivers, three woods, irons, wedges, and then he goes out and then he's rolling putts. Now, for our listeners, all these guys are doing is they're taking one swing at the first tee and then they're walking off.
That's yes.
That's their day, right? And, you know, and so Trevor told that story. And then he said Jack came down about 10 minutes before the ceremony, first tee shot, with that relaxed vibe that Jack always has around him, took about three swings and then went up to the first tee and went. So what you said is so classic. It is important for Gary to, you know, Gary's older than Jack. He's 84. Jack's 80, you know. So, and Gary, as we all know, is a fitness fanatic. So, it was very funny. Those anecdotes just really resonated with what you just said there. But, yeah, the next guys, I don't know. I mean, you know, do we see Crenshaw?
I think he's a favored son.
Oh, he's absolutely a favorite son. You know, maybe this couples do it down the line. You know, even,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's you know, they suspended that for a little while and they restarted it when Jack agreed to do it. You know, because Jack always was. You know, Jack's a really proud guy.
He wasn't going to be a ceremonial golfer.
Always said that, right? And finally, he relented. You know, and it's almost like you know Mickelson to a large degree, like Phil. You know, who I love to death, you know, still believes he's as relevant as he possibly, as he's ever been on the PGA Tour. But the bottom line is, he's not, but he's hanging on because he still thinks he can do it, you know. And, you know, sometimes there's a week that he can do it, you know, and that's what he plays for, that one week when he can do it for four rounds. And, you know, so Jack always said that, but they, you know, it was cool. I was so glad when he did start to do it. And, you know, he embraces it now, you know, and does enjoy doing it. But, yeah, I love the little needle to Gary that I got this morning from him on the email about Gary winning a fourth and fifth green jacket for out-driving on the honorary tee shot.
The book is 7 Days in Augusta. That's author Mark Cannizzaro. And up next, he takes dead aim at a unique coulda, shoulda, woulda at the Masters, as well as its unique pressure. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors, and once again, our conversation with Mark Cannizzaro, author of the new book, 7 Days in Augusta. One of the coulda, shoulda, wouldas to me at Augusta is John Daly. If not for the demons, I always thought with his prodigious length and his soft touch around the greens, he was a natural to win there. I had no doubts that if he could have just put it together and beaten some of these demons, he would have. But in a weird way, Daly's as much a part of the tournament now as any participant, and it's actually bizarre.
It is bizarre. You know, for our listeners, you know, Daly, you know, it's a number of years ago started he would post. He used to post up right across the street from the golf course, right in that Windsor Jeweler shopping center, yes, right across there, in his RV, wearing his loudmouth clothes and just signing any memorabilia that people could get their hands on. You know, all of his stuff that he's put out. And now in the last several years, he's been down Washington Road at the Hooters, very fittingly. And I went down there, actually. I did a chapter on Daly and that whole thing. And I'm telling you, man, there is a line all day long. People just stand in single file in line waiting to get to the table where Daly is signing stuff and chit-chatting with him. And he's great with it. He's really good with it. In fact, my colleague from the New York Post, George Willis, just wrote a column today. He talked to Daly a day or two ago about... You know the fact that there's no Masters this week, and it's the weirdest juxtaposition, because I remember when he first started doing it, he was still playing PGA Tour golf, right? And I thought to myself, dude, you should be across the street, you know, doing what you do, not here, you know. But it just, you know, Daly's Daly.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, he just, he just never committed enough.
In a different world, in a different paradigm.
Yeah.
He could have been Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, absolutely.
The everyman golfer that everyone loved had the funky swing, hit the hell out of it, and was so charismatic. It's always been sort of a sad thing to me. Mark Canisero is the author of 7 Days in Augusta, our guest Taking Dead Aim. We brought up people like Mize and Norman. When I think of them, I think of the pressure at Augusta National, and there's nothing like it. And if it gets you once, it seems to stay lodged in your soul. You brought up Weisskopf. Curtis Strange was another one who rinsed a couple of balls when he had a chance to win and never did. Norman, I think Spieth, when he walks to do a practice round in January to the 12th tee, has to hyperventilate. And I have a theory about Rory McIlroy. It's the one thing left for the career slam.
Yeah.
But after 2011 and what he did on the 10th tee, I'm going to be more impressed if Rory McIlroy wins at Augusta than any other win he's had in his career, because he will have had to overcome the greatest pressure demon in sports.
No, I would completely agree with that. I think that would be his greatest achievement. You know, much like for Phil, you know, I think he sees his greatest achievement as winning a British Open, because that was the one major that people thought he couldn't win because of the way he hits the ball so high and his ball flight and whatnot. You know, and I think Rory, because of what happened in 11, there's no question that, and I think you know, he certainly, you know, it's not something he would talk about now until he does it, but I think if he ever does do it, I bet he'll feel that way. Like he just said, he'll feel that that's his greatest accomplishment. I mean, I think Rory's going to win one of these things one of these days, and I think Spieth will win again, because Spieth played, you know, even in bad years, Spieth has played well there, you know, when he's been slumping.
Yeah.
You know, he's a little bit like Phil. It seems to perk his game up when he drives down Magnolia Lane, regardless of what kind of form he's in. Has anybody had a more volatile relationship, more turbulent relationship with Augusta than Spieth? I mean, his first Masters he almost won. That was when Bubba won, but he finished runner-up, and he was right there. And then he goes and wins the next year, and then the next year he throws it away. I mean, it's just incredible, you know, the relationship he's had with Augusta National.
There's no question. Let's get back to a couple of traditions at Augusta that you cover that, again, from the point of view of someone being there for the first time. It's shown on TV in some of the wide shots, but it's not really, there hasn't been enough homage paid to the great tree in front of the clubhouse that's right by the putting green, right by the first tee. It is the place where my first Masters, I watched people walk out and I'm like, oh my God, Pat Summerall is just standing there.
Yeah.
You know, it is a magic tree, for lack of a better term.
You're literally, you get a neck ache from your head being on a swivel in there. And I do that not as much for the awe of who's going through there, to be frank. It's more about, oh, do I want to talk to that guy? Do I need that guy? You know, like there's
right.
So many people walking through there that I want to interview, you know, or maybe we just want to go schmooze with, or whatever it may be, you know. But, you know, again, for our listeners, it's an iconic oak tree that's right outside the clubhouse, and it's roped off to where the spectators can't get under the tree, or the patrons, I should say, but they can get right next to it, and, you know, they're right there. They can see who's there, and the people that are under that tree are players, caddies, player agents, media, TV personalities, past champions, members, tournament directors of other tournaments, anybody who is anybody that is in the game of golf is moving and shaking under that tree, you know, from Monday to Sunday. For those 7 days in Augusta that I write about, that's where it starts on Monday and it doesn't stop till Sunday night. And they're there, and deals are made under those trees. Interviews are done. I mean, Fuzzy Zeller was interviewed under that tree, famously, when Tiger won that 97 Masters. And that's when he made that, he changed his life with that interview under that tree. I believe it was with CNN. You know, when he talked about how Tiger should have, you know,
fried chicken and collard
greens and fried chicken at the champions dinner, and I mean, you know, Fuzzy's life has never been the same since that interview. And the funny thing is, I interviewed Fuzzy under that tree, the year that, and I used it in the book, the year that there was no Arnie for the first time, and Fuzzy was out there with his green jacket and a cocktail that was about three quarters drank already, and. Something came off the tree, like a little, you know, I don't know what it was, and he fell into his drink. And I remember Fuzzy said to me, he goes, you know, see, that was Arnie. That was Arnie dropping something in my drink from up above. You know, so, yeah, that is, it's TV can't capture that, you know, and it would be boring if you put a TV camera out there and just watch people. They would just see people milling around, but it's about the people who are milling around. One of my favorite things to do, Charlie, is, and we are so lucky in the media, as you know, we have access to that area. We can go into the clubhouse and have lunch.
Yes.
I mean, I have sat upstairs in the clubhouse on the veranda that overlooks that tree, okay, and had lunch when Arnold Palmer's been and Jack Nicklaus are sitting in the next table over, you know, from me and a couple other knucklehead sports writers, you know, having our club sandwiches, you know, and Pete's Cobblers. So I love to sit on that veranda out there and have lunch and just watch all the activity below me from under that tree, and just look at all the people. And it's incredible. It's just hard to describe unless you're there.
Mark, another tradition is, of course, the green jacket for all the hoopla surrounding it. I mean, it's made in Ohio. The buttons are made in Massachusetts. The logo's done here in North Carolina. In person, I've always been struck at how cheap looking it is. Yet there's not a more sought out garment in the world.
There isn't. I mean, I think I did a chapter on the green jacket, and it's estimated to be worth in and around $200, maybe $250. You know, and that's because of all the custom stuff that's done on it, you know. If you're buying it off the rack, you could probably get it at the Salvation Army for about $6, you know. Yeah, it's a bit gaudy, you know, and the interesting thing about the jacket is, you know, is that the members are not allowed to wear it off-site. You're only allowed to wear the jacket while on the property, or I should say whilst on the property, if you will, maybe. And you know, the tradition is the whoever wins the golf, you know, the jacket gets it to wear it wherever he wants for the balance of the year until they play the next Masters. And it's funny, you know, it struck me. Tiger Woods, you know, tweeted something out yesterday or Instagrammed something yesterday. With his two kids and his girlfriend and the two dogs having their champions dinner, and Tiger was in the green jacket, and his girlfriend was clad in green, and the kids were in green, like Masters sweaters or pullovers or something, and they had the actual meal that Tiger was going to have on the menu for last night for the actual champions dinner, which is now postponed, which were fajitas and sushi. I don't know if you guys saw that or listened.
Yeah, I just saw that.
But it was pretty cool, you know, and Tiger is the only person on the planet right now that's allowed to have that green jacket on off the premises because he is the reigning champion.
Real quick, speaking of champions dinners, famously, I guess it was in 89, Sandy Lyle served haggis.
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone say yay or nay on this, but do you have any stories of it, of how many guys took one bite of that out of courtesy and then looked to the regular club menu and said, I'll have the steak?
Yeah, well, I know that a large portion of the guys had the steak. It's not all of them. I've tried haggis the first time I went to the first time I covered a British Open in 97, and I'll never have it again, I can tell you that. It was not tasty.
Comedian Mike Myers said it best. He believed that Scottish cuisine was mostly a dare.
Yes, it's a fair point.
Get you out of here with just a couple of things. The biggest difference between Augusta National in 1997 when I got there, or in 96 when I got there, and Augusta National now is when I got there, that was the old guard starting to die out and the new captains of industry were taking over, and they have become real estate moguls and merchandising moguls, people who figured out how to monetize their tournament to their own benefit where others in the town have been doing it for decades. But specifically real estate, they've spent more than, I don't know, $250 million buying up houses and leveling them, buying a road and shutting it down to create parking and whatnot for the tournament. Just about everyone who owned a home in that area has taken up the National on their generous offer, except the Thackers. Sort of explain who they are and what makes them special.
There's a couple in their 80s there. They were Augusta National bought out, like I want to say, I believe it was 300 acres adjacent to the golf course, and literally, you know, they paid people off for their, you know, above market value for their homes so they could go buy something someplace else. And, you know, some people held out for more money. And this Thatcher family is a couple that has been there for 50-something years. And they raised their kids there, their grandkids. And they held out. They were offered $1.2 million for a house that was probably worth, you know, it's probably worth 100 and something, and they're still there, and they're the only house and amongst that 300 acres that held out. And it's the funniest thing you've ever seen. They've got this one home, you know, that's kind of fenced and hedged in amongst like 300 acres of emptiness, right? And then, and you know, they laugh about it. They say it's like, you know, it's like their own 300 acre farm, you know, 51 weeks out of the year, you know, and that 1 week a year that's Masters Week, those 7 days in Augusta, if you will, it's, you know, those 300 acres are filled with cars and activity. The interesting thing is, the grandson of the Thatchers
is Brownie.
Scott Brown.
Yeah.
And he's a PGA Tour player, and he used to hang out. You know, he grew up at that house, going with his grandpa to the Masters and whatnot. And unfortunately, Scott has not yet qualified for the Masters, and he's been playing pretty well, in decent form for the last few years. And I've just wanted him to win a tournament so badly, because what a great story that would be for him. You know, like Charles Howell III, obviously, who's an Augusta native who has played a number of Masters. What a cool story if Scott, you know, could get in there and play, you know, and qualify for the Masters. But, yeah, that Thatcher family has held out, and they're still there. They've even talked about the fact that the Masters officials have been very nice. They come every year, and they plant azaleas around the house and whatnot. I think that's more of an Augusta, you know, they just want to keep their grounds looking nice rather than keeping the Thatchers comfortable. I'm not sure how altruistic that is, if you will, you know.
The book is 7 Days in Augusta. Mark Cannizzaro is the author. It's available for purchase, download, however it is you consume your tomes these days. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Finally, I mentioned to you my first one was 97. It was your fourth. And then there was last year. Which Tiger victory is better or bigger, in your opinion?
I think 97 was bigger because it changed the landscape of the game, without question. I think last year was much more emotional and surprising. I think there was more. 97 was more about awe. We were all awed by what Tiger was doing in 97. And I think to read the book is to read, if anybody who gets the book, read Paul Azinger's takes on Tiger in 97. He played with Tiger the second round of that tournament.
Right.
And just had some incredible, Azinger is such a colorful character and is a master with his words. And his description of what he saw in that second round with Tiger in 97 was like none other I've ever heard. So I think it was more about awe in 97 and just more about the emotion of the comeback being completed. You know, and the interesting thing about Tiger, guys, Charlie, I'm sorry, is that Tiger's never been a really embraceable guy. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, you know, Phil's an embraceable guy. You know, you can reach out and touch Phil. Tiger's always been very untouchable. You know, he's been the guy that just, you know, the cold-blooded killer, you know. And not a guy that I feel relates to the fans. People are more, they're fascinated by Tiger. They're not in love with Tiger, you know, if that makes any sense. And I think that what took place at Augusta National a year ago this week, people were in love with Tiger that week. You know, they were willing him to win that thing because of all the stuff he's gone through. You know, the personal life stuff is stuff he created on his own. But you know what? The back injuries and the knee and all that kind of stuff, and most particularly the back. That really, nobody at the top of our list, when I say nobody, that includes Tiger, thought he was ever going to have a moment like he had on 18 there last year. And I think that's really why you saw the visceral reaction that you saw on display there on 18. It was like nothing we've seen in any of his other 14 major championship wins or any win that he's ever had in his career.
I'll argue that it's unlike any win that's ever occurred at Augusta National. I've never heard sustained chanting of any player's name. It was as if it was a European soccer match at the end of that. I could have never imagined that sort of raucousness from the Augusta National patrons.
There's no question. And the other thing too that was that seared in my memory of that is all of the players, the fellow players, have hung around to congratulate him, which a lot of the guys do, and a lot of guys are friendly and all that stuff. But, you know, there were guys out there, you know, even Koepka, who's like kind of a RoboCop, you know. Yeah. I mean, Koepka, you know, he should have won that golf tournament. He was right there. He was tied for lead at, you know, at 13. You know, he was
missed
right
makeable birdies at 17 and 18.
He could have sent it to a playoff, 17 and 18. And, you know, the guys, you know, Schauffele, who's obviously a young guy, those guys that were right there and had a chance to win that tournament, I remember interviewing every one of those guys afterwards, and there was not... They all of a sudden became fans of what Tiger had just done, rather than disappointed at the fact that they did not win their first Masters, despite how close they were. You know what I mean? Most guys are gutted, you know, but these guys were like, they had a front row seat to history, and they were embracing that. And I remembered that about those interviews that I did afterwards, you know, under the tree, as it would be, actually. But yeah, the crowd, if you remember that, just a human tunnel, you know, that was formed of the mass of humanity that Tiger walked through to get from the 18th green to the clubhouse, you know, where he could sign his scorecard. I mean, it was you're right, it was like nothing I've seen in the 25 I've covered, you know, without question. It was just something. And I tell you what, I was emotional. I get emotional because I'm a rabid sports fan. I get emotional when I see a guy nobody's heard of win a golf tournament, you know, after a big struggle or something or whatever, in any sporting event. And I never really got emotional at a Tiger win because, like I said, he's not a guy that elicits a lot of, you know, emotions, in my opinion, in terms of, you know, that kind of emotion. But I was emotional, man. I had tears in my eyes, you know, and I'm, you know, watching that take place.
Well, I had them in my eyes and running down my face. I mean, I was there when Earl hugged him in 97, and I was doing good. I was fine right up to the point where Charlie jumped in his arms, and then I was done. I'm like, oh, God.
I thought he was going to squeeze the life out of his daughter. He hugged her so long and hard, you know. And, that was pretty cool. I tell you, and a quick aside to that, I have a routine on Sunday of Masters. That I do, because as you know from being there, Charlie, it's not easy to, you know, especially if you're trying to follow like a lead group or a Tiger group or something, you know, we're normally at other tournaments we're allowed inside the ropes. At the Masters we're not.
No.
You know, we're outside like the fans are, the patrons, and so it's difficult to see sometimes, and it's hard to kind of go from hole to hole and keep up with it. So I actually, my routine is I like to go into the grill room of the clubhouse, have an iced tea or an Arnold Palmer or both, and watch it on TV with my notepad, just kind of that way I can kind of see what the pursuers are doing, what the leaders are doing. I can kind of see it all kind of unfold as they get into the back nine, right? And while I was in there, the entire time I was in the grill room, so were Tiger's girlfriend and his manager and his two kids. And they sat at a table, you know, 7 feet away from me, watching on TV, the kids, you know, unwrapping candy, oblivious to what was going on, and Rob McNamara, his partner and mate, you know, right hand man, and his girlfriend, watching nervously. I mean, they looked like they couldn't breathe. They looked so nervous, and I'll never forget that. And I went out shortly after that to catch the last couple of holes, as they did, and you know, to see the scene on 18 and them on the side of 18 was incredible.
I know it's not the same, but I hope this conversation with Mark Cannizzaro satisfies a little bit of your Masters Jones this week. The book 7 Days in Augusta is available everywhere, but keep in mind, with all that's going on, Amazon may not be your best bet as far as quick fulfillment. Mark suggests you either use BarnesandNoble.com or the publisher, TriumphBooks.com. If you're looking to get a hard copy digitally, it's in your possession in seconds. Want to remind you, keeping up with us on Facebook's a good thing. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Give us a like. Featured there now. Links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. You know, in these times, golf may be the best way to get out and get some good exercise, plenty of ultraviolet rays, the vitamin D, while being able to practice safe distancing and washing your hands all the time. So if you're able to get out, do it. Tee it up and enjoy letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, as always, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here real soon, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.